I don't think a lot of people realize how much goes into the planning and development of a vineyard.
And I look at Sauvignon Blanc too, as it can be very transparent of the farming style.
A lot of people don't realize Sonoma County is 1 million acres. Makes us about the size of Rhode Island as a state.
For most people who are really into wine, being a wine dude, a wine nut, or whatever you want to call it, I think they all have a wet dream to make their own wine eventually.
I really have fun with doing my job, with doing wine, with being viticulturist.
You know, to stay out of the vineyard, I only have the shotgun for the boar, and I'm thinking, great.
As much as I love Chardonnay, I didn't want to spend my nights worrying about it and my days talking about it.
I worked 14 hours the day before I went into labor. I was determined to get most of that Chardonnay in.
In another beautiful, sunny day in Napa Valley, in a room full of half crazy, half passionate people. I mean, how bad could it be?
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 191. This week we feature Stu Smith of Smith Madron Winery on Spring Mountain in Napa Valley. Talking with Stu Smith of Smith Madron Vineyards and Winery on Spring Mountain is to get a strong sense of what Napa Valley was like back in the 1970s. Stu goes way back to 1971, a time when there were very few wineries in the valley. Along with his winemaker brother Charlie, who we interviewed for podcast 94 back in July of 2013, make exceptional Cabernet Sauvignon, Riesling, and Chardonnay. This interview was conducted mobily while touring the property with Stu. So I'm just going to introduce this while we're rolling along here. Sure. I'm here with Stu Smith of Smith Madron up on Spring Mountain. How you doing today, Stu?
Just great.
It's great to be here with you. You know, you guys have long been one of my favorite wineries. One major reason, you make some damn fine wine.
That's the only reason for existing.
We go along with that. Well, and drinking it too, I'd say.
Well, yeah, but you got to make it before you can drink it.
That's true. It makes it a lot easier when you do that. So we're kind of going to go out and do this as a mobile one today, which is kind of fun. We're kind of heading down the slope here, and maybe you can tell us.
There's a row of olive trees that dates back to the beginning of the vineyard in the early 1880s. So it's about 130, 135 years old, something like that. We've got Riesling on the left, Chardonnay on the right. You can see the clusters there. Chardonnay is the furthest along. Riesling's coming along, a bit of a weed patch because of all the rains this year.
When would you think you'd pick your Chardonnay?
Well, as the saying goes, if all things being equal, I think we're probably right on schedule.
Yeah.
So I would say in the first week of September. But there's many a slip between the cup and the lip between now and September 1st. We've got all of June, all of July, and all of August. And if it's a cool summer, all bets are off. And if it's a hot summer, all bets are off. And what most people don't understand is that really it's the last month or 6 weeks that defines wine quality. Whatever the climate is now, it only affects the quantity of the crop. And the real quality is the last 6 weeks, 8 weeks, you know, basically from a little bit after veraison. Veraison is where the grapes either the red grapes turn color or they soften and get bigger. But up through, you know, June and July, the weather is immaterial to the vintage, to the quality of the vintage anyway. For your listeners, we're going up through a forest of Douglas fir, Madrones oaks, black oaks, tan barks. This is a young vineyard of Cabernet that we planted in 2010. And it's on a 10 by 6 spacing. We use 8 foot T-posts that go up at about 38 inches, 40 inches is the first cross arm, what we call the fruiting wires. Mm-hmm. And we figured that is the appropriate height for ergonomically being correct. And then 12 inches up from that, we have a 14 inch cross arm, 24 inches up from the first, you know, the fruiting wire is a 32 inch cross arm, and then 3 feet up is a 36 inch cross arm. And you can see here, the Cabernet is in full bloom.
Sure.
So this is September 4, 5, something like that. What is it? September 4?
Yeah.
June 4.
Yeah, and, you too.
Right. And so we're in full bloom, whereas we drove by the Chardonnay, it's not only past bloom, it's gone through shatter, and you got little berries sitting there. But this is kind of interesting. This row, these rows, when we first planted them, went across the slope.
The other direction.
Yeah, we originally planted this in 74. And so that was more of an east-west basis. And the problem with that is that the sun's all in the southern, we're at latitude 38 and change. Mm-hmm. Sun's south of us, so only the south-facing fruit got sun. Everything on the north side, or on the north side of the cluster, got no sunlight. And one of the great advances in viticulture is one called canopy management, which is the trellis system, and two, row direction. And we learned somewhere in the late 70s, early 80s, that we needed to get sunlight in on the grapevines. Right. And if your rows ran east-west, basically you had uneven ripening. So as I like to say, we're smart little boys and girls, and if that's the case, then let's plant our vines north-south, because you get an even amount of sunlight in the morning, you get an even in the afternoon.
Sure.
But in that deal, I'm going to take the morning shift when it's cool and nice and the vines have had all this time to recover. I'm going to give you guys the afternoon shift where it's hot, sunny, they've been out there all day. And being, you know, from whatever, you're going to say, well, that's not really fair, Stu. Okay, California's all about being fair. So we'll kick it off to a northeast, southwest direction. So 55-60% of the sunlight will be on the morning side, 45% will be on the afternoon side. And then the trellis system, by having this kind of arching trellis system, shades the grapes themselves during the hottest part of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get dappled sunlight on the grapes themselves in the early to mid-morning, and in the afternoon you get it from mid-late afternoon to late afternoon. So where you want the vines, the grapes themselves protected, is in the hottest part of the day. And so that's what the whole trellis system and row direction is designed to do. And then we originally planted on our own roots in 1972. And then we expanded out the vineyard with AXR number one, that's the rootstock. And then with phylloxera, we had to rethink all of that.
And so, you had phylloxera later here, right?
Yeah, phylloxera didn't hit us until the mid-90s. It hit the valley floor in the early 80s, and then with the flood of 86, it just spread it everywhere.
When that all happened, I mean, when it got to you guys here, did you expect that?
Was oh, it yeah. Kind of... Yeah, I mean, it was just a question of time. In fact, when we made the decision to plant on our own roots, we did so because we were the first vineyard in Napa Valley to have what we call heat-treated certified plant material. And in fact, we were a increase block, and everything that came off our vineyards could be sold as certified, which we did,
oh, nice,
to help make ends meet. And what I mean by that is that these vines were grown, originally the mother vine was grown in a high-class of greenhouse of Phytotron, and the grapevines grew very, very fast. And they outdistanced the viruses that were in the plant itself. So the researchers took literally the apical meristem cells, mispropagated it, and then everything was grown from those very few plants that had been basically microscopically detached from the plant and distanced from the virus.
Mm-hmm. So that makes them
virus-free. Yeah. No, there's no such thing as immunity. They were as virus-free as we could humanly
sure.
get. Now, there's been issues in the last 45, 50, you know, years where that's gotten a little bit more complicated. But suffice it to say is that this was a great deal, a great achievement, because all of the vineyards, not all the vineyards, but damn near all the vineyards that turned red had virus. That was leaf roll virus. And so we got rid of those viruses. We were able to get the vines to be healthy. And consequently, we had better quality wine and frankly, slightly better production. And you can see how the vines are starting to arch up in a V shape.
Exactly.
See how? And that's what we're trying to do here, obviously. And then we're also dry farmed, even though we have drip irrigation here. We start the vines with water.
Mm-hmm.
And the first year, we give them as much water as we can, which still isn't very much.
And the next year, there's a little bit less, and the year after that, less. And somewhere around the fifth, sixth year, we'll cut off the water entirely if we think the vines have done well enough. And then they're on their own. As I like to say, kind of tough love.
Yeah, just like your children.
Yes, exactly. Now, like kids, occasionally, they come home. And last year, we discovered that, you know, we had a Merlot child that had to come home and really wasn't doing very well. And we had to quick fix all the water lines and give it a little bit of water. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned subsequent to that in a couple of dry farm seminars I've been in, I'm, you know, still learning.
Sure.
I ran across an article where they claim that Merlot is a difficult variety because its stomates, which are the openings on the underneath side of the leaf, work differently than other varietals. And Merlot appears to be a variety that may not be a good candidate for dry farming. Now, we have one block of Merlot that has never had water. Mm-hmm. But it was on AXR number one. We now use 1103 Paulson, and maybe that rootstock with Merlot isn't a good combination, or AXR was just such a, and it was a terrific rootstock with one fault, which is that it was susceptible to phylloxera, damnable things.
Fault.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's a rather killer fault.
Just to interrupt you for a quick second, is there any other possibility that, you know, the placement of the Merlot? No, it's not? Okay.
No, I don't think so. I mean, we've looked at soil. We've looked at how we've handled it. I'm pretty good at this stuff.
Yes.
Well, the bottom line is that I really don't know the real answer, other than I'm starting to see literature that says Merlot as a varietal is maybe not the variety that you want to, you can go toward dry farming. And we should all, whether you're in the valley floor or in the mountains, strive toward the concept of dry farming. Whether you achieve perfection or not isn't the point. California is a drought-sensitive area. Grapevines and olives are the one products that can be grown in the mountains with little or no water at all. You know, as I'm fond of saying, Virgil said in 43 BC, Bacchus amate colus, which is Bacchus loves the hills. And not only for what he did, a tree stand farming, and it was kind of interesting. He says, growing grapes, this is in 43 BC, he goes, growing grapes, a lot of work. You got to be out there all the time taking care of them and pruning them and suckering them and positioning them and all this other stuff. He says, you plant olive trees, all you do is harvest them.
Nice. Yeah.
And I'm going, wow, some things just don't change. So anyhow.
Well, let me ask you this. You guys came here, is it 73, was that right?
71.
71, okay.
As a matter of fact, I first walked the property in the early fall of 70.
So what made you decide on this property? What did you put into this idea of you were going to be here?
Well, as I like to say, there's certain fundamentals in the wine growing and winemaking industry which are pure. And I believe that it's unassailable that the best wine comes from the best grapes. And in my view, the best grapes, all things being equal, come from the mountains. Now, that doesn't mean that I am dumping on the valley floor, because there are great wines that come out of the valley floor and there are junk wines that come out of the mountains. But all things being equal, over the long run, you're going to get, in my opinion, the very best wine coming out of the mountains. And so I wanted to be in the mountains because I wanted to make the very best wine humanly possible. Mm-hmm. And I found this, it had been vineyards, like I said earlier, in the 1880s. Those vineyards had been died off because of phylloxera. There were trees that were Douglas fir trees that were 2.5 feet in diameter, 80, 90 feet tall. And at the base was a little grape stake pooched out at a 45-degree angle. So I knew the soil was good. Stony Hill was our immediate neighbor downslope and to the east. And they made, and still do make, one of California's best Chardonnays. So I knew I was in the right area. It was pre-Napa Valley, pre-oil embargo, pre-Cuisinart, pre-inflation, pre-Napa Valley.
Right, right.
Napa Valley was a sleepy little agricultural community, provincial at best, I don't think there were 30 wineries in existence. And I knew I wanted to be in Napa Valley and not Sonoma Valley. So those are the things that brought me here. And it was just serendipitous. I happened to be at the right place at the right time and was young, stupid, had a strong back. and ignorance is bliss.
And a hell of a lot of work ahead of you.
Oh, yeah. But you see, that's where the ignorance comes in. Because if you really knew how much work it would be, you really couldn't do it.
I couldn't even imagine. I mean, just because of the sheer size of the property, the slope, everything.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost like everything's against you when you start out.
Well, yeah, but that's where the ignorance is good. I mean, look, I did my master's out at UC Davis. If there, I have any claim to fame, it's that I was the department's first teaching assistant. And I taught for 12 years after that, a couple years at Napa, and, oh, I don't know, 10 years over at Santa Rosa JC in the evening program. And so I bring a technical point of view to all of this, which both gets me into trouble too, but because I don't suffer fools easily with this stuff. And I don't know, it just seemed like, as I like to say about my kids, it was a good idea at the time.
Well, it's an incredible piece of property. In fact, we were interviewing down at Stony Hill with Sarah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a great interview. It was a lot of fun. And she, of course, spoke very highly of you guys up here. Which is kind of neat because, you know, for us city folk, getting bearings on a mountain, you don't.
Yeah, hop back in and we'll drive over here and you can see our lower vineyards are very close to Stony Hill's upper vineyards. And then we'll go back up to what we call the Wedding Grove, which we are in the process of completely redoing because we had two great big Douglas fir trees that were 75 years, 80 years old. I don't know how old they were, but they were big. And they finally succumbed to the drought. So we've had to redo everything. So
keep on going. About how many acres are you planted here again?
We're about 36 acres in vineyards. When we're completely replanted, we're somewhere just short of 40 acres, 39, 40. I don't know. All depends on how you count.
And about how many cases these days?
We're about 4,000 or 5,000 cases. Last year was a walloping disaster as far as grape quantity. We were about 45% down from the previous year or two. And a lot of people think it was because of the drought. It wasn't. It was because of really inclement weather during bloom. And the 2015 vintage was quite an early one. And partly is because it was a warm winter. And as soon as spring came around, it turned overcast, drizzly, nasty, right in the middle of bloom. Now that vineyard down there that's kind of facing us, just past those Douglas fir trees, that's Stony Hill's upper vineyards. This is our lowest vineyard, which is or a lower eastern block, which is what we call the Point Field Cabernet. And we'll swing around to go back up and show you the, you get a better view of everything from the top.
For as long as you've been in business, as long as you've been doing it, you've managed to keep your pricing structure pretty stable, which for the kind of wine you're making, that's pretty amazing these days.
Yeah, well, because we were able to start it a long time ago, we have a certain advantage. But the other thing, too, is that, kind of the curse is that because we've been around so long, we think our wine prices are expensive. And other people's wine prices are just stupid. But we're catching up. We do have some expensive wines. Our Cook's Flat Reserve is $200 a bottle. We just released some 2005, re-released 2005 Riesling and Cabernet, and we think pretty highly of those wines. And $175 for the Cabernet and $75 for the Riesling. But we think our what we call our estate wines, for lack of another word, really should be at the upper end of affordable drinking. And then the reserve is really the collectible size of things. I don't know. We just do what we can as we can, and we don't do any discounts. We don't do any razzmatazz. We don't play games like a lot of wineries do.
Well, I think, too, your history here, like you said, you went back to when there was nothing
I seem to remember Charlie saying, especially up here on the mountain, you guys were kind of lonely up here.
Oh, we were, no question. There were a lot of really great guys that I got to know. One of the summers when I was at UC Davis, I worked with Andrei Chelychev for a good part of the summer, so that was fun. And, you know, Chuck Carpi and Laurie Wood and Joe Heitz and Louis M., Louis P. We've been around a long time and know those people. And I'd say, you know, take a shot at a lot of these new folks. One of the problems I have is that a lot of these folks that are coming in today really don't have the respect and really the obligation to the Valley that those of us who came before them have, which is that, you know, I always feel as though I came to the Napa Valley for what other people had done, and I feel as though we have an obligation to give back to the Valley, both in wine quality and you know, to help make Napa Valley sustainable in the long run.
I was talking to one winemaker, in fact, Linda Neal from Tierra Roja, talking about the idea of owners working the property, that you're starting to see less and less of that.
Yeah, that's been a trend, and that's partly because of regulations, because it's really hard to be able to.
What's the latest thing I heard a year or two ago, that the billionaires are driving the millionaires out of the Napa Valley? You know, and there's a certain amount of that, and then you look at who's buying up everybody, the cost of operating. You know, back to our deal, when my brother and I were, you know, we planted the vineyards, we built the winery, we grow and make the grapes. When we were building the winery's poured in three slabs. And we'd poured the first and the two outside slabs. And I'm looking at the middle, and I said to my brother, Charlie, I said, look, if we don't get underground now, we're never going to get underground. He goes, yeah, good idea. So I called up the building inspector, and I said, look, I want to put a cellar in. He goes, okay. I go, what do I got to do? He says, well, sketch something out on an 8.5 by 11. Come down to the office Thursday at 10 o'clock and bring a check. I don't think I had 7-8 hours. Driving down there, sketching out what I wanted, and I don't know, the check was $150. Well, today, you're looking at 6 months, maybe a year. To do a modification wineries in Napa Valley, you're looking, in some cases, if it's what we call a major mod, you're looking at 2 years for a permit, plus maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars in studies. And it's just insanity. And California is gonna kill itself. It already has killed itself, in my opinion, from an economic point of view. They're making stupid rules, and anyway. Let's not go there. Especially for a state that's so much agriculture. I mean, this is one of the greatest states when it comes to agriculture in the country. To do that is cutting its nose off to spite its face.
Oh, yeah. Well, as an example, Napa County has two ordinances. The winery definition ordinance and the conservation ordinance, also known as the hillside ordinance. So from a political point of view, a lot of wineries can only have so many visitors a day. We're by tour, because we have a very old permit, we are tours and tasting by appointment. Everybody except for the very biggest and oldest wineries in the valley floor are tours and tastings by appointment only. Now, some wineries can only have like 9 people a week. Well, I mean, how stupid is that? You go into Safeway and they say, okay, we can only have 300 customers a day, and after that, we're going to close their doors. I mean, as long as you have safety and sewer and things of that nature, the county ought to get off of our back and let us do the things. We're the only county in America that grows grapes where we can't host weddings at wineries. That's why I call this area the Wedding Grove. just because it's my pushback,
yeah, right,
being politically incorrect. Yeah. That field over there, which is what we call the North Slope, for lack of another word, it's over 30%, some of it. And because of that, we have to go through a CEQA process. If we could get the permit, it would cost us upwards of $20,000 an acre through the permitting process. And that's just the estimate. And if somebody decides to sue the county over it, we're held responsible for that lawsuit. Oh, so the sky's the limit. To get a permit in Napa County, you now have to sign a document indemnifying the county over any lawsuit. It's so anti-business, is just insane.
Yeah, it makes no sense.
And so the only people who can afford to come here now are the Mr. and Mrs. Gottrocks, who sold their widget company for $1 billion. And they bring a different attitude toward the valley, toward wine, toward people, toward preserving the Napa Valley and making it go forward. So it's a interesting time.
And on the other hand, as you talk about preserving the valley, What are we at, about 1,500, 1,800 feet? Or are we?
We're about 1,800 feet right here.
And we're looking down on this part of the valley. I mean, we're going to have some video of this, but it's beyond stunning. You know, the flatland down there surrounded by the mountains, it just takes your damn breath away.
Yeah.
This is really, and this idea of preserving it is so important.
And the only way that, you know, my undergraduate degree from Berkeley is in economics. I was a macroeconomist. And the only way the wine industry is going to survive in the long run, in other words, 200, 300, 400, 500 years, 1,000 years, is if it's economically viable.
Sure. Nobody's going to want to get in if they can't make a buck.
Exactly.
Or pay for it.
Or pay for it. And wine grapes are what I call the climax agricultural product. It is the only legal product that can compete with housing developments. And...
Wow.
It's kind of an interesting little factoid. Leland Stanford and his wife were looking at putting Stanford in Calistoga. And for whatever reason, decided at the last minute not to do it and went down to the peninsula. Can you imagine if Stanford had been put in at Calistoga?
Not in a million years.
Yeah, right. Well, Napa Valley wouldn't exist.
No, it wouldn't exist. It'd be a giant suburb.
It'd be a huge suburb.
Yeah.
With even... you know, gridlock, subdivisions, all of the things that come with it.
What about your future, you know, between you and your brother? I don't know if you have any children or, you know, where you think your winery is going to go in the future here.
Well, I hope it keeps going just the way it is. I have my son working with us, Sam. He's done harvests all over the world. His last one a couple of years ago was Dr. Lohsen in Germany, and he's done Washington, Napa, Australia, New Zealand. He's traveled the world and, you know, he's working with us. So that's great. And hopefully there's a future there for this. But we're still a small kind of unsophisticated winery. And we'll see how it goes. But that would be nice.
Please stay unsophisticated.
Yeah. Well, we're doing our best. I mean, this is how I go to work. I go to work clean. I go home dirty.
Good. Well, that's how it should be with an owner. And, you know, a lot of people, you'd like to think, get into grape growing. Part of it is to be, well, so many of you guys are farmers. It is about a hands-on job.
Well, I love what I do. There's no question about that. Charlie and I work 6 days a week, 7 days a week during harvest, and we love what we're doing. And it really is very, very cool in that you get to play in dirt. And then you have your product, which is wine, which is, I think, the coolest beverage on the face of the earth. There's never been a better, neater, wonderful product, elegant. And then you get to have it at a dining room table.
Right.
And as I like to say, food is life-giving and wine is life-enhancing. And at the end of the day, sitting down with a glass of wine with family, friends, the day just washes away from you. And it's our goal, and quite frankly, egotistical. We're here to make the very best wine humanly possible.
Well, you do a damn fine job. Stu, for our listeners who'd like to come by and visit, and I know you guys are obviously, as you said, by reservation, how would they do that, and how would they learn about you online?
Well, we have a wonderful website, smithmadrone.com, and you go on that website to learn everything about us, and then that's how you make appointments to come see us, is that it's now all being done on the website, which is, you know, a little, it's just what we have to do. We used to be able to talk to everybody and figure out exactly when they could all come, but we've gotten a little too popular for all of that. It's either myself... Charlie does most of the tastings. If he's not around, I'm there. So when they come here, they get an owner. Sam fills in occasionally too, and so a little different. But
We try to accommodate as best we can, but it's a small winery. It's a working winery, and everybody's got to work around one another.
Well, especially with this kind of history to come up here, this is a, in my opinion, a must-see. Again, I'm looking at this insane view. We're sitting here chatting here casually. It's crazy. It's stunning and it's beautiful, and this is what you get to see every day.
Well, I don't get up here every day, but when I get up here, I do love it. And years ago, in the, I don't know, I call it the period of long shadows, which is where on a late afternoon and a clear day, today's overcast, but on a clear sunny day, toward the end of the day, everything kind of turns really still, and the cloud or the shadows on the other side of the hills there, because the sun setting over there, all turns into these long shadows. It's just a magical time. And then Mount St. Helena, you know, as a little kid, we recite, you know, the purple's mountain majesty. Mount St. Helena turns purple on a fairly regular basis when you're sitting up here, and it's really very special. But there's still an awful lot of work to do, and I'd say one of the negative things is that I'm never caught up. There's always a list that seems to grow instead of getting shorter. I've had things on the bottom of the list for 3, 4, 5 years that I still haven't gotten to. Farming, especially farming in the mountains, is a project where you are never done. But it's also satisfying. It's just, it's frustrating at times because, like I say, you're never really on top of everything, but it's very cool.
I love hearing you talk about it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you taking the time. This is great.
My pleasure.
Learn more by visiting smithmadrone.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2016.